Good morning and welcome to the Advent of Fall edition of Mountain Money. Your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning and happy fall, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone. Happy fall. It's gorgeous out the window here.
So before you go on your mountain bike ride or your hike, spend the next hour with us. We've got some interesting stuff. We're going to start by speaking with author Shoshana Walter about her new book, Rehab. It's a look at the rehab industry in this country, and it's pretty disturbing. Then we'll speak with Park City local Dr. Emma Kane Loudon. She's the new president of SLU and a newly graduated PhD in astrophysics from Yale.
And then we're joined by Vanessa DePalma-Wright and Jackie Zahner of District F. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Addiction is an incredibly widespread problem in this country. For years, the response to those suffering from drug addiction has been rehab, rehabilitation. And while this program and other media outlets have shined spotlights on the role of Big Pharma in fueling the opioid crisis, little attention has been paid to the rehab industry that far too often is part of a repeating cycle of relapse and sometimes overdose. Author Shoshana Walter shines a spotlight on the industry in her new book, Rehab, An American Scandal. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Shoshana, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, about 8 years ago, I was a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, a longtime criminal justice reporter, and I just kind of stumbled across this program that courts across Arkansas and Oklahoma were using to send people to in lieu of incarceration. So this was a rehab program where people were supposed to be receiving treatment. And when I did a little bit of digging into this program, I learned that it had been founded by a former poultry industry executive and that the program was sending people to work without pay at for-profit chicken processing plants where they were making chicken products for KFC and Popeyes and Walmart and PetSmart, and they weren't getting paid anything. And this was predominantly their sole form of treatment. What was being called their sole form of treatment. And I never heard of anything like this before. And it just made me want to understand how common that is. And, you know, if in this day and age, when so many of our lawmakers and policymakers, and court officials, prosecutors, defense attorneys, so many of us now consider addiction to be a disease worthy of treatment and medical care. It just made me wonder, you know, what does the rest of our treatment landscape look like? Is it actually serving people the way that it should if we want to get more people out of this cycle of addiction? And that led me down the path to this book.
And one of the things about the book is the stories you tell make it pretty clear that this is not what people would think was being done. I mean, you know, I think people have a vision of, you know, smart people with clinical experiences thinking carefully about a process that, you know, has some inpatient time and then has sort of, you know, transition and support. And that's not at all what you found. I learned a lot from this book.
I'm glad to hear. Thank you. For reading it.
You chose to tell the story but it was an interesting approach. You sort of took four individual cases and said, you know, and followed them and told their stories. Why did you choose that approach? And did you actually come to form relationships with these people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've known these four individuals now for 5 years, in some cases longer. It started with Chris, one of the people in the book. He was a young middle-class white guy from Louisiana who was court-ordered into this program that required him to work without pay up to 80 hours per week in really tough manual labor jobs. You know, it started with Chris. He was the subject and one of the subjects of a podcast series that I did when I was at Reveal called American Rehab. And then I just broadened my reporting lens. You know, I really started from the ground up in trying to understand what does our treatment landscape look like? How has it changed over the course of the past 25 plus years of the epidemic? And what are the major problems that I really need to address in this book? And so that's how I came across the other individuals that I ended up writing about. I discovered that there are these treatment medications, buprenorphine, methadone, that are proven to reduce overdose deaths by more than 50%. And yet they're incredibly difficult for patients to find and access. And so I devoted a thread of the reporting to understanding why that is and what that looks like. And so that's how I found Dr. Larry Lay, who was one of the first Suboxone prescribers in the nation, who ended up getting raided and arrested by the Drug Enforcement Administration for providing treatment. I also found that there's still huge barriers to treatment for so many people in this country, you know, people who really are in need of help instead of incarceration, still have trouble accessing treatment. And that contributes to this cycle of relapse and overdose and addiction. And so that's how I found April, who is a Black mom of three in Philadelphia, who ended up separating from, who ended up getting separated from her children because she could not find treatment for her addiction. And then the other major thread of reporting that I uncovered with this book is the for-profit addiction treatment industry that has really proliferated in the aftermath of the Affordable Care Act. And now it's become a major, one of the main source of treatment for most Americans. You know, millions more Americans have access to treatment thanks to the Affordable Care Act. But I found that these treatment programs are often more focused on billable services than on individualized patient care. And that's really contributed to this relapse overdose cycle that often happens with rehab. You know, sorry about that.
It happens.
You know, I found that most insurance companies will pay for no more than 30 days, maybe 2 months of inpatient treatment. And we now know from research that someone who completes a 30-day treatment program is much more likely to overdose and die in the year following treatment than someone who doesn't complete that program at all. So there's a way that we're funding treatment in the system that is actually contributing to the problem rather than providing people with what they need to actually recover in the long term.
So let's go back and talk a little bit more about Chris's story, because, you know, it is a fascinating story. He's, as you say, he's a white middle class kid. Talk about how he gets into the system and what his experience was at Centocor.
Absolutely. So Chris got started using drugs when he was 15 years old. He was showing off on a three-wheeler and broke his ankle and ended up with a pain pill prescription. And that sort of started him off on this period of adolescent experimentation with drugs that led in his young adulthood years to addiction. And his parents were really desperate to get him help. They sent him to a 30-day program. It was, by all accounts, a good quality program. Chris felt like he got something out of it. But then he left that program and came home, and he relapsed almost immediately. It's a very common experience with these 30-day inpatient programs. And he ended up getting arrested and sent, court-ordered, to this program called the Centocor Foundation in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And the Centocor Foundation sounded really great to Chris and to his parents. You know, he was told that he'd be living and working there for 2 years. He'd be able to save up money for after he left. He'd receive medical care. He'd receive counseling. But then when he arrived, he learned that he would be working up to 80 hours per week in these really tough manual labor jobs. And he would not be compensated. His main compensation was a pack of cigarettes per week. And he rarely had time for counseling. I spoke with Chris's counselor at that time, and she told me that she would poke her head into his room after a long day of work, ask him how he was doing, he'd say fine, and then she'd mark that off as a counseling session. And these were difficult, really difficult jobs. I mean, during the time that Chris was there, Centocor had sent people to work at Exxon and Shell oil refineries. He was building scaffolding at chemical plants. He was laying asphalt in the broiling Louisiana heat, cleaning up after LSU football games. You know, he actually was able to easily obtain drugs on some of these jobs, because in some of these cases, it's actually really easy to find substances that might even help with the difficulty of the job. And so he relapsed on numerous occasions, and he also was badly injured in the program. And eventually, Chris ended up getting kicked out of Centocor after 18 months in the program. He was sent back to the county that he came from. He assumed that because he didn't complete the program, he would be sentenced to prison. And that is often what happens with these programs. You know, people get sent to treatment, and if they fail to complete it, if they relapse, then they end up getting sent to prison. And that's what Chris assumed would happen to him. But he got a second chance. The judge decided to give him probation. And that's when Chris really began the hard work of trying to recover and move on with his life.
And in a sense, this is a happiest story in the book, in the sense that he goes on to get married and sort of establish himself with a middle-class kind of existence.
Yeah. I mean, one of the key points that I make in my book is the importance of recovery capital. And that is the term that researchers have for this mixture of external and internal resources that people need in order to enter recovery and sustain recovery. And that can include social and community support. Chris had the support of his family and his friends. And it can also include financial security, housing, a job, transportation, food, adequate health care. The more recovery capital someone has, the more likely they are to be successful in their recovery process. And Chris, thankfully, came from this middle-class family that was able to provide him with that level of support. They helped pay for him to get on Suboxone, and he was able to move on with his life. But it's much more difficult for people who don't have the same level of recovery capital.
Which naturally leads us into a discussion of April, where we have a different story and a different set of circumstances. Let's talk a little bit about her saga.
Absolutely. So April is a Black mom of three from Philadelphia. She herself grew up with a mom who was addicted to crack cocaine. And one of the things I learned in reporting this book is that during the crack cocaine epidemic, our country had a very different approach to addiction. You know, at that time, addiction was considered a moral failing that required punishment. And people were incarcerated en masse, particularly Black and brown drug users, like some members of April's family. And so she really bore witness to the impact of those policies in her own life and her community. And then when April got older and she went through some childhood trauma and she developed an addiction, you know, she was still functional. She was taking care of her three kids, but then she was sexually assaulted. It sent her over the edge. She started to lose control of her addiction. And, you know, in this instance, what would have been most helpful for April and what research has shown is most helpful for mothers struggling with addiction is a treatment program that would have allowed her to bring her children with her. You know, studies after studies have shown that such treatment programs have better outcomes for the entire family. And we know that about 70% of women who struggle with addiction have children. It's one of the top reasons that women cite for not entering treatment. And so April might have been able to enter treatment at that time, but she had no one who could take care of her kids. There was no child care available to her. And she was the sole caregiver for her kids, the person making money and providing housing. And so she wasn't able to get the treatment that she needed. And ultimately, April's kids were taken away from her by child welfare authorities. And that pushed April even further into her addiction. She became homeless. She began engaging in sex work to support herself. And really the only thing that kept April going was the memory of her kids, was the little glimpses she would get of her kids from time to time. And finally, April decided like she needed to stop. She was motivated to stop. And the only thing that she could do in this moment that she knew she had the opportunity to do was to get herself arrested. And that is what allowed April to begin her own recovery process, which took a lot longer than Chris because April did not have the same amount of recovery capital. And so it took her a lot longer to get back on her feet. And what we see again and again in addiction is there are collateral consequences to addiction. The longer you are in your addiction, the more marginalized you are. And those barriers, those obstacles become as much of a barrier to recovery as the addiction itself. So time and again, we see people relapsing because they're not able to find housing, or they're not able to find a job to support themselves, or they have immense guilt over having been separated and not there for their children. And so it can take a very long time for someone who's new to recovery to accrue that recovery capital and get to a point where they can sustain long-term recovery and, in April's case, reunite with her children.
One of the striking things about April's story is at the beginning of her story, you're talking about her relationship with her mother. And she has this attitude that I'm never going to end up like in this horrible situation that my mother did. So she starts the story with this attitude of, I see how things can go horribly wrong and it's not going to happen to her. And yet it does.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, April, she, as a kid, she was like, there's no way I'm going to ever end up like this. You know, she had this dream, like maybe she'd become a lawyer or a police officer. And I remember her telling me about, the DARE officers that would come visit their neighborhood and show these images of drug addicted people. They looked like zombies. They had, you know, they had these vacant stares and these pockmarked faces. And April didn't feel like those people really resembled actually anyone that she knew. But the message that she got from those presentations was, just say no, you know. So that was her mentality. I'm just going to say no to this. I will never be like this. But of course, you know, substances provide something to the people who use them, you know, and for many people, substances become a coping mechanism for unaddressed mental health, for unaddressed trauma. And when mental health care and addiction care is not accessible to people, they rely on the coping mechanisms that are around them. And for April and for many members of her family, those were drugs.
Yeah. Now, we've touched on this, but I want to zoom in on a little bit, which is, to what extent does the way in which the government and insurance companies approach the concept of rehabilitation, how does that contribute to this cycle? Because I think you mentioned that it, just offering somebody 30 days doesn't seem like a very logical way to actually get at the problem.
That's right. I think for the most part, the way our country approaches addiction is as a short-term acute problem. So you go into treatment, you finish that treatment, and then you leave. And that's supposed to have provided you with all that you need in order to recover from your addiction. But in fact, what the evidence shows is that longer-term treatment and longer-term care is more effective, and relapse is a part of recovery. And so ongoing care, ongoing support, and providing people with the opportunity to accrue recovery capital, to accrue these resources that they need in order to actually facilitate and sustain change, is what's really going to help people fully recover and move on from addiction. And the system we have set up right now is just not providing that. You know, I spoke with a lot of treatment facility owners who were even frustrated by this. You know, even the best intentioned facilities are frustrated that they're often limited in the services that they can provide to these very short-term spurts. One treatment company owner that I spoke with called it a cycler. You know, people come in and they come out and then they relapse and they go back in again. And I think, unfortunately, in our for-profit treatment industry, that's often now become part of the business model. You know, that same treatment company owner actually employed staff who would call up former patients, find out if they'd relapsed, and then re-enroll them if they did. And that was considered, you know, the treatment facility's aftercare program. So rather than providing people with ongoing support or helping to create a plan for that ongoing support, a lot of treatment facilities are just taking them back in, and then the insurance money starts all over again, and it can be very lucrative.
Okay, so this seems like a model where the 30 days runs out, the insurance company stops paying, and they basically shake your hand and say goodbye, rather than having an ongoing process, which would be consist of maybe social workers and other kinds of support post-inpatient post the residential stay, that model just isn't there at this point.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, for the most part, yeah. I think what we are seeing again and again and again is people entering these short-term programs, leaving, and then entering again. Yeah. I mean, even in the course of talking with people after the book has come out, you know, I've met parents who sent their kids to treatment 24 times. I was just speaking with a woman the other day. Her daughter went to 24 different treatment facilities. And that's not uncommon. I mean, the average, the research shows that most people go to treatment an average of 3 or 4 times, but there's a substantial number of people who go to treatment 6 or more times, and even more in many instances. And I think that's an indication of how difficult it can be to recover from addiction, but also it's an indication that the system that we have is not operating the way that it should in order to actually support people who are trying to enter recovery.
I want to talk about Dr. Lay, because we've touched on this drug Suboxone, and lots of people have heard of methadone. I wouldn't be surprised if many of our listeners have never heard that word before. What is it? Why is it significant? And how has the government approached its distribution?
Absolutely. So these are medications that are essentially substitutes, you could say, for illicit opioids. And they fill or partially fill the same receptors in the brain that illicit opioids do. And what that does is it takes away cravings for illicit substances. It prevents the onset of withdrawal symptoms that usually comes when you stop using illicit substances. And it basically just makes anyone who takes it, who's been using illicit drugs, feel normal. You know, they don't feel that desire to use, and they don't feel a high. It just basically normalizes them. We have this law that was passed over 100 years ago. It was our nation's first federal drug law, the Harrison Narcotics Act. Sorry to get in the weeds here. Sure. But this, I would say, had a really outsized influence on our addiction treatment policy over the past century, because essentially what this law did was it made it illegal for doctors to prescribe narcotics to people who are known to be addicted. At that time, you had doctors who were trying to treat people who had grown addicted to certain substances like morphine or opium or laudanum, and they were attempting to treat those people by maintaining them on those substances so they could function, or by giving them those substances in diminishing amounts to kind of wean them off. And there were clinics all over the country that were operating this way. Well, after this law was passed, and the precursor to the Drug Enforcement Administration was created, you had thousands of doctors arrested for providing these medications to people who are known to be addicted. Something like 25,000 doctors were arrested in the time period after this law was passed. And so I think one enduring legacy of that law is that it created this separation between addiction treatment and mainstream medical care. And our addiction treatment system really developed in a silo away from our medical system. And it created a stigma around addicted patients, treating addicted patients, and kind of scared doctors away from providing care to addicted people. And so ever since then, we've had to create exceptions in the law to permit the prescribing of addiction treatment medications like methadone and what would later become known as Suboxone. You know, there was an exception made in the law for methadone that allowed addicted patients to obtain methadone through these specialized clinics that are again separate from our mainstream medical system and often require patients to come in daily to receive their dose, require regular drug tests. It can be very punitive, surveillance-oriented arrangements. And then when our country launched Suboxone at the turn of the century, the Suboxone was a little bit different from methadone in that doctors could prescribe it out of their doctor's offices. But when we first made this medication available in the United States, lawmakers imposed enormous limits on the number of patients who could receive it and the doctors who could prescribe it. So at first, doctors were limited to only 30 patients, and they had to obtain special permission to prescribe it. They had to take a specialized training and a test and apply for permission, and they had to submit themselves to the oversight of the Drug Enforcement Administration. And that agency has always been very suspicious of methadone and buprenorphine or Suboxone. And so you had this situation, especially in the first 10, 15 years of the opioid epidemic, where this medication that could have been extremely beneficial to the American public was hard to come by. There was an enormous barrier to obtaining this medication. And so one of the people that I follow in my book, Dr. Larry Lay, he was one of the first Suboxone prescribers in the entire country during a time period when very few doctors were signing up to prescribe this medication. And Dr. Lay, you know, his clinics, they were not the model of addiction treatment, but he did his very best to make it as accessible as he possibly could. And he found a way to prescribe to more patients than were legally allowed under this patient limit under the law. And because of that, he drew the scrutiny of local law enforcement and the DEA, and they sent in a number of undercover officers into his clinics, investigated him for months and months, and ended up arresting him, raiding all of his clinics, shutting them down, arresting his entire staff. They put out a news conference where they called him the Pablo Escobar of Suboxone, and many of his patients ended up relapsing. They were cut off from their medication. Some of them overdosed and died. And then Larry Lay was put on trial, and he was acquitted. And all of the charges against his staff were dropped. And when I first met Larry, you know, he was just desperate for someone to tell his side of the story, because his life had kind of been thrown upside down by this. He had a history of alcoholism. He relapsed. He lost his medical license, and he just wanted some acknowledgement that he had provided access to this important medication during a time period when it was really direly needed. And so, you know, in talking to Larry, I was able to read through his entire criminal case file. I mean, these are records that are typically confidential and totally off limits to reporters, and I was able to review the entirety of the DEA's case, watched hundreds of hours of undercover agent footage, so I could really see, you know, what these clinics looked like and what the impact was on these patients that were suddenly cut off from this very important medication.
Last question before we go. How would you like to see the model changed? If we as a society want to have a meaningful and effective approach to rehabilitation, how should the model be different?
Well, I think what I have learned from my reporting is that this model of short spurts of 30-day or 2-month-long treatment programs, that's just not working. People need to be able to access longer-term treatment, ongoing treatment and support via medications like Suboxone and methadone, and people need to be able to overcome the consequences of their addictions. People need to be able to accrue recovery capital. You know, those resources that people really need in order to enter and support and sustain long-term recovery. That needs to be a part of any treatment model, is figuring out how people can access those resources in order to actually sustain long-term recovery.
The book is Rehab, An American Scandal. We've been speaking with the author, Shoshana Walter. Shoshana, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Roger, for having me.
We'll be right back after this. Dr. Emma Kane Loudon recently completed her PhD in astrophysics at Yale and has embarked on a career as the president of SLU. We're going to find out what that's all about and more. Good morning, Emma. Thanks for being here.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
So Emma, tell us a little bit about your journey that has gone from Park City High School to a career in the stars.
Yeah. So I grew up in Park City. I have been born and raised, well, not born here, but moved when I was 3 months old. So basically born and raised here and have really loved getting to be in the Park City schools. It was a big part of who I am. My interest in astrophysics, which is what I majored in college and got my PhD in, started actually with a class at Treasure Mountain in, it would have been eighth grade, and you do the circle of all the different sciences. And Ms. Dewis had a quarter of physics, and I absolutely loved that physics unit and spent just so much time soaking up the material. And she told me about this amazing thing called astrophysics, which I had never heard about before, and helped me to understand that there was a way to combine a love for math and science that I had with an interest in space. That continued with support from amazing teachers throughout my whole time at Park City High School. The math teachers there, Mr. Nordfeld in particular, really continued to stroke that interest, and Mr. Matthews in physics. And I found this interest in looking at the night sky, which was largely sparked from growing up in Park City, where you can see the Milky Way at night. I was very grateful to have a group of friends around me at Park City High School. The community there was amazing, and there were a bunch of other people in my class, and specifically other girls in my class, who were really interested in science too. And Miss Jones, who's the chemistry teacher at the time, she used to call us her science goddesses in training. And I've always loved that phrase. It connected us together so well. And that
she reminds me of Miss Frizzle from that TV show.
Absolutely. The hair is kind of similar. yeah, absolutely, from the Magic School Bus.
Magic School Bus, thank you.
Yep, such an important path for so many people into science through that show. Yeah, so that really launched my path into astrophysics. I ended up going to Princeton and studied there for undergrad, researched exoplanets, so planets outside the solar system, trying to understand how they form and evolve, and then did a fellowship program called the Brooke Owens Fellowship that actually sent me to D.C. for the summer, where I got a crash course in space policy and learned how this world of astrophysics also intersects with the money that funds it and how that happens in the federal government, and also all the laws and rules that help make space exploration happen. So I came back with a real interest in this intersection between industry, academia, and policy. And before I pursued my PhD, I actually briefly considered going into space law instead, which, believe it or not, is actually a field that people can go and do quite a lot of interesting work in. But then now just finished up my PhD in exoplanets at Yale, working on all of the, like, how we learn about exoplanets and how we find and discover them in the universe. And now I'm at SLU, so it's a perfect intersection of all of those things.
Wonderful. Great shout-outs to our wonderful educators here in Park City.
We love our Park City teachers.
Absolutely. So what is the mission of SLU, and how does it operate?
So SLU is really built around reconnecting everybody to the wonder of the night sky. As people in Park City can relate to, when you look up at the night sky here, you can see the Milky Way, you can see the stars. That's something that I did not appreciate, that not everybody in the world really has that connection to or has access to. There are a lot of people who, for light pollution purposes or just life, you don't spend time pausing and looking up at the night sky, let alone learning anything about what you're looking at. So SLU is on a mission to reconnect humanity to that wonder of the night sky by providing access to the stars. So we do that through a network of 10 telescopes around the world that provide 24/7 sky coverage and that are accessible online through, all you need is an internet connection. You can access it on a computer, a tablet, a phone, and schedule your own missions to take images of the night sky and really reestablish that connection to what is actually happening above us.
Wonderful. And how is SLU funded?
So SLU is a private company. We sell memberships to schools, to districts, to families, to individuals. Anybody can join SLU. We have a number of amateur astronomers who are on there who actually, it's so fun, they actually submit their observations to the Minor Planet Center at Harvard, which is where they track asteroids. So it's not only a fun and fun tool for hobbyists, but it's also a place people do actual science that contributes to our understanding of the night sky as well.
So if I sat down, if I had a, is it a subscription?
Yes.
Is that the right word?
Yep.
If I sat down at my computer and I wanted to look at something, is there something available 24 hours a day because you've got 10 telescopes around the world?
Yes, which is one of the most fun parts, and a solar telescope too. So you can watch the surface of the sun.
And how do I talk to the, for lack of a better term, how do I talk to the telescope and tell it what I want to see?
Yeah, so I think this is actually one of the coolest parts of SLU, because you talk to telescopes the same way that professional astronomers talk to telescopes, where you go in and you schedule a mission. For the younger audience on it, we have a way to just pick, like, if you want a picture of the moon or a picture of Jupiter, you can click that and then click the telescope. And if you're more advanced, you can put in coordinates in the night sky and actually pick that way.
So is there an AI interface that would allow me to say in English, I want to see Jupiter, that will then translate into coordinates?
That's happening behind the scenes,
right,
for those. Yeah, but yes, that's
yeah.
happening behind the scenes for sure. In those drop-down menus, yeah.
That's pretty. So it's almost like when we would use webcams to check ski conditions, but you're doing that to check out the storm on Jupiter.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a really amazing way to be able to see what's in the night sky. And it's also cool because it connects people to what is actually visible right now. So if there's if you can't observe something in the northern hemisphere right now, you learn that, oh, maybe you could observe it in the southern hemisphere depending on the time of year. So what's actually moving around up in the night sky.
So is there like a splash page, you know, that says, these are really cool things you should try now?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So we have something called the SLU 1000, and you can try and collect it over the course of the year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and tell us about, so is this being used by schools? I mean, how is that used in an educational setting?
So in an educational context, the other key component of the platform is what we call quests, which are really curriculum-aligned lesson plans that teachers can use in their classrooms and that are already built into the platform. We have over 100 of them. They have pretty advanced physics and astronomy built in and can be used in College 101 astronomy courses or even for majors and researchers, but they can also be used down at a kindergarten level. And teachers can assign these quests to their students, and the students go through the quests and as part of the quest capture the image. So it's really their picture of Jupiter, their picture of the moon. It's not in a textbook. It's much more hands-on, interactive.
Unbelievable. So I'm looking at the website right now, yeah. And I'm looking at the Orion complex.
Yeah.
And so it's colored.
Yes.
And I assume you are putting a color to the gases that you detect coming off the
nebula.
Complexes, the group of stars.
Yeah. So there are filters on the telescopes that help do that and collect
the
image in different colors. And then when you layer them together, you get those beautiful multicolor images that you see.
You do get the sense there's an awful lot going on behind the scenes here,
yeah.
right? Between someone sitting at a computer and saying, I want to see this and how it actually works.
Yeah.
How many employees do you have that are doing all that back-end stuff?
So right now our company is about 15 people, so it's still pretty
wow.
small. Yes, it's very small right now, but we have an amazing architecture all built up, mm-hmm. and what you're saying about all the stuff happening behind the scenes, what I really love about it is that it happens behind the scenes for a kindergarten student, but then for our amateur astronomers subscribers, they get access to all the different filters, and they can take those images and put them into other software and do more advanced details with them. It's awesome kind of interaction.
Nice. So space exploration and the development of space science in this country typically tied closely to NASA. And recent budget cuts have been affecting the development, everything NASA. What kinds of effects, I mean, how are the recent budget cuts affecting you and SLU? Is it at all?
So we're not at all government funded, so we aren't directly affected. One of the things that I'm thinking about a lot is that part of the proposed budget cuts include zeroing out NASA's outreach and education budget. So I'm excited that there are companies like SLU that can be in the schools and be out there with people talking about space and being a part of vehicle for education. I mean, my experience with NASA when I was little, I literally sent a letter to NASA and they sent a letter back to me from their Office of STEM Engagement with seeds that had been at the International Space Station and a letter, definitely a form letter, but I had it hanging in my bedroom for years and I loved it.
But Emma, moving away from SLU for a minute, sort of changing our focus. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, you obviously in a cohort of graduate students in a very specialized field. How is what's going on with NASA affecting sort of their perspective and affecting what you see as the future of the science that we're going to need to develop space exploration?
So very much affecting everybody who's interested in any sort of astrophysics or space science research right now, because the cuts that are being proposed would be about a 24% cut to NASA's budget. NASA's budget in 2025 was $24.9 billion, and it's going to be proposed $18.8 billion for next year. It's almost a quarter cut. And for context, those numbers are big. Billions are big. But it is 0.3% of the U.S. budget. It's less than half of a penny of every tax dollar. And the ROI on NASA investments in the country and really in the world is some of the highest of any government investment. And then on top of that, there's the much harder to quantify soft power that we get from being a leader in space science. I'm really worried that as we go forward, my other fellow graduate students who are still in the program, it's going to be harder to find jobs. It's going to be harder to get data. It's going to be harder to just interface with your scientists, other scientists, if there's no money and budget to even go to conferences. Like, the very basic levels of all of this are going to be dramatically impacted by cuts.
And obviously that creates a risk of major brain drain.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, already people in the programs I know are looking to go to graduate school in Europe or elsewhere where they know that there's going to be continued support.
Yeah. Emma, before we go, I want to change the subject yet again. You recently authored a children's book.
I did.
What inspired that, or what's it about?
Yes. So my children's book is called Mia and the Martians. It is inspired by how I fell in love with space. So back before Ms. Dewis, before I discovered what astrophysics was, I was already really interested in space because I had loved learning about the rovers Spirit and Opportunity. Part of NASA's outreach is an amazing website full of games that kids can play. And there was a game where you would load this rocket and press the big red button and it would launch to Mars. And then you would see and learn about these two rovers that landed on Mars. So I wrote this book about a little girl named Mia who goes to Mars and meets all the rovers there and gets to learn lessons from them about the surface of Mars and the search for life on Mars, but also lessons about emotional intelligence from their names. They're named by kids, and the names are things like curiosity and perseverance and spirit and opportunity and ingenuity. So it lends itself to that sort of engagement. I'm also really fascinated in general by the anthropomorphization of space rovers and like spacecraft in general. The fact that people cried when Cassini went into Saturn or when Oppie sent that last tweet back that was like, my battery is low, goodbye. And there are videos of people sobbing. I think that's so interesting that we care so deeply about these hunks of metal on another planet.
Well, didn't they dedicate so many years of their lives to get it launched, to get it built here on the planet and then launched and then, oh. Yeah, I would cry too.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an amazing adventure to go put those objects there.
So what you've done is you've stealthily buried a lot of education into a fun children's book.
That's what I love to say that I've done. I hope so.
Now, are any of these sort of rovers, are any of these things still alive on Mars?
Yeah, so Perseverance, more colloquially known as Percy. Percy is still on Mars, roving around, and she's collecting samples of Mars surface soil, and she stores them in a laboratory in her belly. And it's a really amazing testament.
And where can our listeners find this book?
On Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, Yay. On Bookshop, at Dolly's, at Barnes & Noble in Park City.
Mia and the Martians.
Will you be doing a book signing for that book?
I just did a couple, but I'll be coming back to Park City again to do
more. Yeah, awesome.
Okay, Dr. Emma Kane Loudon, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
Hey, we are back with you. One of the best things I get to do on this show is to learn about the new businesses, projects, and other ventures here in our area. And that's exactly what we're doing next. Learning about District F from Vanessa DePalma Wright and Jackie Zahner. Thank you for joining us this morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Good morning.
Okay, so you heard it. It's lesson time. We're going to learn some stuff about District F. What is it, and how would you describe it to someone, you know, like me, who's completely unfamiliar with it?
So when you think of the F word, think of District F, think of me. But in all, I mean, I got to be funny,
start.
Right? Because now I got your attention.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. District F is a creative collaboration between She Money and Farasha. Both of us have been in this community for a long time. We're business owners, we're entrepreneurs, we're engaged in this community. But basically, it's a fresh, current of the moment, immersive space in the heart of the Iron Horse District. And it's bringing together fashion, photos, fets, finance, and feminism. See, we're
it's on a lot
roll
of
here. It's a lot of apps.
We've got more apps, too.
There's a whole theme going on. But really, I mean, in all seriousness, it's fashioned, it's designed and built with intention. It's a fusion. It's blending fashion, community, and experiences. It's fluid. We're adaptable to actually meet the needs of our clients and our customers. And finance, really stressing the power of the purse, right? Now more than ever, with tariffs, with the current situation of the world, I think we can be very intentional, especially as women, in how we spend our money, how we support the community and local businesses. And we want that. We want District F to be a hub for that. But the three things I want everybody to take away is, and here's a fun fact, there are no photography studios in all of Summit County. And I have been in the fashion industry for 15 years. And every time I do a photo shoot, I schlep it to Salt Lake. I love Salt Lake City. But I think it's time. I think Park City is kind of in a creative renaissance, as I like to call it. Development is booming. I think retail is finally at the forefront of where people are saying, I want to do a pop-up in Park City. And having been in this industry for a long time, looking at places like Aspen, they've been doing it for years. And, you know, when we came into the forefront doing pop-up boutiques, people didn't know what they were. And now everybody's doing them, from Apple to Walmart to emerging designers. I think it's kind of, it's an in-the-moment experience that you can offer to people when they walk into a store. So think photography studio, think retail space where you can actually set up for a pop-up, and think events. We're thinking bachelorette parties, we're thinking book launches, money talks, a place where people can really come, connect, thrive, succeed. And I'll leave you with this. Our tagline is lights, camera, cash flow.
Lights, camera, cash flow.
Lights, camera, cash flow.
Love it. Love it. But there's a look, we instead of cash, can we use an F word? I'm going to have to put a five-second delay on
it.
There we
Finance.
Go. Finance flow.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So you just mentioned clients and customers. Who are your clients and customers? I mean, who do you cater to? Would it be photographers, event planners, artists?
Absolutely. All of the above.
All of the above.
So first and foremost, our clients, Farash's clients, are women in our community who are entrepreneurs. They have small businesses. They're full-time moms. And they want something different. I think not everybody wants to stroll around in their Lululemon. We can help connect to emerging designers who have something different, unique to offer. And we want District Def to be a hub for that. A place where people can come to be styled, but also obviously photographers. One of our big strategies right now are to partner with all of the local publications so that they know that they have a space that they can rent hourly, half day, full day rate. And we'll work with them from A to Z. We have a space for hair and makeup. We have an area where we can style people that come in. Another target market would be real estate agents. I mean, your headshot is your most important tool. Everybody uses it on all of their marketing, their social media. So a place where you can come and get styled, we can help, you know, do your mini headshot. It doesn't have to be an all-day shoot, but we can put you together with the right photographer, the right team, and then events. I mean, that's part of the reason why I think this is, you know, a key collaboration with She Money, in that they have been doing events and they've been doing it right for a long time. They bring women together to the forefront where we can all, you know, succeed and thrive together. And so we see it as a space where, you know, we want people to think about, right now we're having a lot of requests for, you know, women's parties, book launches, bachelorette parties. So we want it to be a fluid space that can really transform to whatever the needs of our clients are.
So how big is this space?
We're about 1,500 square feet. And then obviously She Money has their office space. And then our entire space is photography studio, retail space, and an area for events that's all mélangé. But we can cater that space and design it, you know, as the client sees fit.
Very adaptable. I like that. And I hear there's a kitchen there. It's a gourmet kitchen?
Well, no, it's just like a small kitchenette area.
Okay.
Like if we wanted to have like appetizers. And we actually did a really fun dinner in August for the Dandelion Dinner. It was a conversation about climate change, and we had about 16 people there. We did a private chef sit-down, three-course dinner. We have a garden that we also have been using for like our cocktails or grand opening events. And I think one of the key factors, you know, I'm a Main Street girl. I've been operating on Main Street now for 15 years. I like to walk to town. I like to be in the center of the action. But the reality is that the Iron Horse District is, it's centrally located. It's a place where people can come, and there's parking, which we know is very important, especially if you're doing an event or a photo shoot, parking. But we're centrally located. I think it's a great space for people to...
So I'm trying to visualize that. At 1,500 square feet, how large an event can you comfortably host?
Well, so this is one of the things I learned post-pandemic is, you know, before the pandemic, we were getting paid to just shove as many people into a space, get as many eyes on a brand. And things shifted after that. It was more about an experience and creating something that is completely intimate, where people can connect, learn about each other, learn about the brand. Why is it that I want to buy this product? Why is this brand interesting to me? And so the way I see it, I think the happy number is 50.
Okay.
Our capacity goes up to 100. But quite frankly, I think it's the 25 to 50 that really makes it a more, I think, impactful event. for the brands and for the customers attending.
So you'd mentioned feminism. So I picture you holding an event, like a full-day conference for women entrepreneurs who, you know, a full day in your place, 25 of them, comfortable seating where they can really focus on just what the subject of the conference. Is that one of your
model
future? Yeah, absolutely. So She Money, we've been around, 5 years now, and we were anchored at the Kiln for many years, which is a space we absolutely loved. Yeah. And we loved the partnership we had around space to do events both in Park City and Salt Lake. And we did events ranging from 10 people gathering together to tell their money stories to a conference for over 500 people. Wow. That we had at the Hilton just over a year ago. It was the She Money Summit, I think one of the largest financial events for women in the state ever. Hmm. So we're hoping to bring that kind of, as Vanessa said, both intimacy into event spaces. For example, just a few weeks from now, we're having, you know, one of our collaborators is an amazing author. Her book is actually coming out tomorrow, and she'll be in Park City, so I'm hoping you might invite her.
What's
to
her
come
book?
Speak with you. It's called The Trauma of Money. Mm-hmm. Mm. And she's a unique collaborator with us. And my background is financial services. I was a partner at Goldman Sachs. I've been passionate about women's financial agency education and engagement, and everyone's financial literacy is a big issue for everybody in financial education.
Particularly here in Utah, where bankers don't tend to talk to women.
Yeah,
it's extraordinary.
Well, no,
it's
that's true. There are a complete lack of advisors that get me on the soapbox on that one, like any time, by the way. So we have events. So part of mission of me, you know, setting up She Money here in the state of Utah, which ranks, by the way, as the worst state in the country for gender equality. Hope we can say that word on the radio these days.
Absolutely.
So is to do more around financial engagement and tying women into the economy. So spot on, we want to do small intimate events. We want to do larger scale events. Some will be in our space, some will be outside of space. But the big word is collaboration.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We just spent a few minutes with Jackie Zahner and Vanessa DePalma Wright of District F. F word is the key there. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. We wish you the best and look forward to checking out more stuff.
Thank you for having us.
We'll be right back after this.